Okay, welcome back for a second edition of Up Back Through, a podcast brought to you by Running the Show, a blog for everyone in love with the beautiful game. So, as I said in the first episode, we weren't really sure what we're going to settle on for a name, but it looks like we have settled on a name now. It's a new name, and that's Up Back Through, a soccer coaching podcast. So, that is what we are, and that is who we are. And actually, who we are is Eddie Prue and David Cellini. And we are two soccer coaches of different natures. I'm a skills coach based in Seattle, Washington, in the United States. And David is a more traditional coach, team coach, tactical coach in located in Linköping, Sweden. And yeah, David, good morning, man. Good morning to you. Good night to me. But how are you?
Yeah, good morning, Eddie. I'm well, thanks. I had a really good session last night, so I'm kind of a high of sorts, a good session high still, despite the night's sleep. So, yeah, I'm doing really well.
Nice, man. That's good to hear. It's good to hear that coaches get, you know, like a little buzz off their trainings too. When we know when the ball's popping around and stuff, they can take pride in that too. So
yeah, when the tempo's high and like passes are flying in and out, being sipped between the players, I get something out of that, definitely.
Good, man. Good. As you should. But yeah, no, this is going to be a great episode because, yeah, it's going to be fun. We're going to do a lot of comparing because we're going to look at player development. And as you know, we didn't get to watch any club soccer this weekend, which was, you know how those weekends go. But it's fun to see the international games and all the drama that those bring. It's a lot of talking points, but we're going to talk. I don't think we're going to talk about any games specifically so much as we're just going to talk about a few players that we want to highlight and kind of go down the road of development and see where it takes us. Because the thing that I want to point out here is, okay, you're Swedish and we know each other from me playing over in Sweden and we coach together and we, you know, we just I learned a ton from you, and that's our relationship. And then, you know, we went down this path of player development, and you know, what we were so like, you know, curious what situation makes the best player, what factors, you know, all these different things that can go into how a player develops and how a player turns out as a professional. So what I wanted to look at is a couple of players from Sweden and a couple of players from the United States who all played for their countries this week. So from Sweden, I want to talk about Dejan Kulusevski, who is a 20-year-old winger who plays for Juventus in Italy, and also Alexander Isak, who is, I believe, a 21-year-old. I think he's 21 years old. He's a striker. He plays for Real Sociedad, and formerly of Borussia Dortmund in Germany, and before that, AIK in Stockholm. So he's 21, and these are the two players on Sweden that I kind of highlighted as, you know, world-class players. Like, Isak has, I mean, you could argue he's dipped a little bit in recent years. I mean, he's only 21, so to already have, you know, quote-unquote recent years in your career is something special, but he, you know, as a 21-year-old, but he's been professional, I think, since he was 15. Is that right? Do you remember?
Yeah. He broke into the AIK team when he was around 15, 16, and started training. And then actually, I think he played quite a few games when he was only 16 and scored a lot of goals, actually.
Right. Yeah.
In Swedish top division, Allsvenskan, which obviously then got him the move to Dortmund. So yeah, he's been around, and he looks a real talent, and he's really benefited, I think, from going to Spain, where it seems like there's more of a technical focus on in terms of training there, and it's really benefited him so far. So he's looking really good, and you know, he linked up with the big man Zlatan at the weekend, and you know, it just can't be a bad environment to learn in as a young player playing next to a player of that quality and experience.
Seriously, yeah. I mean, if there's one or two or three players you want to learn from, who are still playing, it's probably Messi, Ronaldo, and Zlatan at the moment. So maybe Lewandowski or someone. But I mean, yeah, that's an amazing experience, and it's cool that Zlatan's back in the national team after having retired. But he's got some juice left, that guy. He's still going. He's still going strong. So, but anyway, yeah. And Isak, I've heard rumors recently. I've heard things linking him to Barcelona. I've heard things linking him to Man City. Who knows what'll happen with him? But he will be a top class striker, I believe. But anyway, so those are two young players from Sweden. And then two young players from America are going to be Giovanni Reyna, who is currently at Dortmund, and he's only 18 years old, and Christian Pulisic, who is at Chelsea, and he is, I believe, 20. I want to say he's 23. So the older of the quartet, but definitely not an old player by any means. So I guess one statistic that I want to point out, or not even really a statistic, I'm sorry, Pulisic is only 22. He's not 23, so he is a young player as well, and he's probably the most accomplished thus far four of those players. So the U.S. has produced these two players and many others, but we're a country of almost 340 million people. Okay, that's a lot of people compared to Sweden. Sweden are producing as much or more, you know, top European talent. And you guys have 11 million people, not even 11 million people in your country. So, I mean, that just begs the question, you know, what are you doing that the United States is not doing? There's better examples of that. There's Iceland, you know, a country of, I don't even know off the top of my head how many people are there, but you know, they're doing well in European competitions, and it's such a mystery, you know, and that's what I want to kind of get into to start. So I guess for your experience is the most it's going to give us a unique insight, because you know what happens to a player in Sweden on the developmental side from start to finish. You've seen young players travel all the way up to big clubs and probably some national team players. So why don't you just kind of just talk, Dobbs? I just want to hear what you have to say about development in Sweden.
Yeah, I mean, basically, development in Sweden is based around grassroots football and academies. And the two players you mentioned, Kulusevski and Isak, they both joined academies while still very young. Both of them are from the Stockholm area, and Kulusevski came through at a club called BP, which is one of the best academies really in Swedish football. And then Isak, obviously, as you said, at AIK. Kulusevski had a bit of a different pathway since he went to Italy and Atalanta when he was only 15, and then continued his development there. But both of them came through the academy system. And I mean,
I'm going to ask you questions as we go, just to make things more clear for a lot of our American listeners and beyond. But so at what age will a player typically join an academy in Sweden?
I mean, the teams that the clubs that really do have academies are the teams in the top two or three divisions. So they can be that they're allowed to have something called an academy, and they have teams already from, I don't know, the ages of 7, 8. But it's not really a question of recruiting players at that age. It just, you know, for some people, their local team might just happen to be AIK or Hammarby or a team like that. So they will join them. And then there are hundreds or thousands of other clubs around Sweden who aren't allowed to be called academies, because their first teams aren't playing for some of the, you know, top, I don't know, 50, 60 clubs in the country. And those are the only ones who can actually be called an academy officially. But I mean, those clubs still function in a very similar way by having a lot of training sessions for young players and working on skills or working on their game intelligence and how they read the game. And that's a big thing as well in Sweden, that we've gone away from focusing on the physique and the and the technical skills and moved more towards the mental state of reading the game and understanding the game. And we the pathway now is that every club, every coach that goes through the Swedish educational ladder, if you will, and go through all the levels of getting your coaching badges, they will be kind of steeped into this philosophy of, okay, we need to work on how players, that they actually play games, that they play in training, so they always work on their decision making. And we believe that that is the thing that will make talented young players into great players, that they are clever, and that they can read situations that happen on the pitch and then quickly decide on what to do and make those decisions into actions like passes or a covering position or a shot or a dribble or whatever it might be. So that's like the big thing in terms of what we actually do teach, that we look at, okay, so if we play, you will work on everything. You will work on your physical ability, because you obviously have to run and you have to cover and you have to sprint, and you'll get all that. And then you'll need to use your technique, because you need to handle the ball. You need to practice your technique for, I don't know, tackling, or for just how you position yourselves when your teammate is pressing, and you position yourself behind the ball. And then you work on your passing, and you work on your shooting, and your receiving, and your dribbling, and you get all that by playing games. And that might be a 3v3 when you're really young, and that might be an 11v11 when you're older. But we always look at, okay, how can we get players into game-like situations to work on their decision-making and their reading of the game? So that's the big thing we work on. And I don't know what it's like in America, but that's like the thing we've really pinpointed from the Swedish Football Federation in the last, I would say, 10 or 15 years, that we really changed that. Because previously there was a big focus on, you know, the physical ability of players or simply the technical ability. But those two things don't really matter if you don't have the intelligence to actually execute your actions at the right time, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I would argue from a skills perspective, from a more general technical and, you know, and not so much a physical standpoint, that the most important would be players' intelligence. But you can be an intelligent player, but if your technique and your actual touch on the ball is poor, then you can't exactly execute. But the least important of those two, of the three of all those aspects that you just discussed, is your physical attributes. You know, it's a shame when players are kind of like disqualified from selection or consideration just because they're not like a traditional physical specimen. But anyway, it sounds like Sweden is focused a lot on making players smarter and making them more match ready, match friendly from a young age. That's another aspect that I don't want to just, you know, sit here and complain and give you a bunch of reasons why America is not as good at soccer yet. It's a process. We're not, you know, we're figuring it out slowly, but we're definitely not on the largest scale yet, on the largest stage just yet. But we don't, in my opinion, Dobbs, for youth development, is you definitely have to be in game situations. And obviously for players as young as 6 and 7 and 8, you know, you're going to get them on a small field, of course, get them a lot of touches, you know, get them in situations where they are in front of goal, you know, and where they can have little, you know, like smaller numbers and smaller sided situations that will mimic bigger games, you know, where they can maybe like have a transition on a small field, or they can, you know, like identify that they are in the attacking third now or something like that, you know. So I would agree. But the thing that if I can kind of add in another point that I think is incredibly important that a lot of people don't talk about enough in America is the lack of access to fields and I'm gonna argue for futsal courts, which is good enough. There's not enough places to play. You see you see so much in America, people in parks that just set up goals with their bags and their and maybe some cones or whatever, and that's great and all, but it's not the same as actually being on a pitch of some sort. It's just not. And the access to that is so limited in the US. It's really tough to get field time a lot of the time for kids. It's, you know, it's not right there in a park near their house, you know, and a lot of skills, a lot of countries who develop skillful players, they have, you see them in Sweden all the time, and all over South America. When I lived in South America, they were just everywhere, in Spain and all through Europe. They're everywhere. It's like the basketball goals with the futsal goal on the bottom of it. I don't even know if it's futsal. It's just small sided fields everywhere. But the point is, you know, you have access to these things that are fun. It's so fun to play, you know, five-a-side or whatever it is on those little courts. It's, you know, and just to touch the ball and be on a pitch. So that's the limited access to that in the U.S. is, in my opinion, a huge hindrance. So like you said, the sooner we can get kids on a field, the better. The better they'll develop as a player, their maturity, their IQ. I just read a quote the other day from Mourinho. It was so good. He said that he's had to adapt to what a 23-year-old is nowadays. You know, he said, when I was at Chelsea and I was coaching Frank Lampard as a 23-year-old, he was a man already. This was a fully professional, you know, just laser-focused adult man. And a 23-year-old these days is a little different, according to Mourinho. But the question is, you know, how do you develop players maturity-wise? Like, you know, how do you get players more adult-like, if you will, to be ready for that next level, to be ready to be playing with grown men? What do you have to say about any of that development?
I think that's very difficult because each individual is so different. But in terms of the system we have, like I just touched on it briefly, that we have, you know, grassroots clubs and then obviously academy clubs, and really you would spend your entire youth playing for clubs. We don't really have school football. We have school football as something extra for players that are really interested. So when you go to primary school, you can even have, you know, extra football there at times, and especially when you go into middle school and high school, you can have extra football in your curriculum, where you might just have a few sessions that might not be of the highest quality at all times, but at least you get to play. That's something that a lot of kids actually choose to do because obviously they enjoy and they love the game. And then when you get to the last stage of your schooling, we call it upper secondary school, when you're around 16 to 19, you can join a school that has a national football program. So then you have 3 sessions a week during your school days, and you train with really good, certified coaches, and then you will do that during the day, and then at night you'll go and play for your club team. So you basically play at 2 places all the time, and maybe that's something that will help you grow because you will learn from different people. So you have one team at school. You know, you don't play games, but you train with that group, and then you go and train with your team, your club team, and then you have different coaches. So you have to learn how to deal with different people because you won't have just one coach. You might have 4 or 5 coaches split on the two places where you actually go and train. But the big thing we have between the highest youth teams, which go to around 19 years of age, and the first teams, is we have a league called the Under 21 League, but that's also only for the academy team. So for the top 50 teams in the country, they will normally have an Under 21 team, where young players will play with senior players. So you would say you're in the Under 19s of Club A, and then your first team have a game, and a few of those players aren't in the team, so they need to play a game, and they will drop in to play with the under 21s. And then, I don't know, 7 or 8 players from your under 19s will move up and play with the under 21s. And then you can play like with senior players against other senior players and against youth players. So you get a sense of maturity from that, because you obviously learn from all the people. So that's like the only football organizational thing we have that we can actually bridge the gap between being a youth player and a senior player. Otherwise, that's up to the clubs really of, okay, so how do we handle our youth players? So is that by moving them up to train with the first team and try and get the maturity that way? Or is it by loaning them out to clubs further down the leagues where they can learn to play against seniors, but in a more it's not familiar obviously because it's a different club, but it might be a more relaxed setting when you play it at, I don't know, Division 3 or Division 4 level compared to playing for like Superettan or Division 1, which are our second and third levels really. So that would be the one organizational thing we have to actually bridge that gap, the under 21 league.
Yeah, and that's a really good that leads us nicely into another problem with American soccer is in Europe you have these clear paths. You know, you join a club and you can see the teams that are above you all the way up to the first team, up to the, you know, to the senior level, right?
And, yeah, very much so.
Yeah, and that's so nice. Whereas here in the U.S., if you do want to pursue professional soccer, if you do want to see how far, you know, soccer can take you, you play for your club, you play for your high school, but then you think about, okay, well, the next level involves going to university. Those things are intertwined here, education and playing your sport most of the time. So now you have to think about what you want to study for 4 years, what you want to, and then, you know, like all these different factors, all these things you have to consider. It's not just soccer anymore. It's a lot of life stuff. And, you know, I don't want to criticize that because it's well-intentioned for sure, but it's definitely not, you know, it takes your focus off of just soccer at very, very important developmental years from 17 to 21, about right around there. So your path is really, it's not very clear unless for the rare case of players who play in the academy of an MLS team and they just go all the way up. They go all the way up to the MLS team. Sometimes MLS teams have a professional team underneath them in the United Soccer League or the United Soccer League 2. We have a new pyramid over here. So sometimes there is a stepping stone, another level of professional before you get to the MLS, but it's becoming more and more common, but it's not near. I mean, the numbers are not even anywhere near what other countries produce themselves, you know, like for players who are in the system and travel all the way up to the senior level. It's a very different system over here. But I love that, and it's also just a matter of accessibility, because here's another thing about European soccer, is that it's very much the idea of a neighborhood team is very much alive, you know.
Yeah,
everyone has a club in and around their town, you know, and most of the time several clubs. Where you can theoretically, you know, if the club itself does well enough, you could play at the highest level in Sweden with your hometown club. Every club has the potential to play in any league if they get promoted and everything. It's all, you know, and some teams obviously have no chance, but the thing is that there's opportunity like that. Whereas in the United States, for example, I live in Seattle, in the greater Seattle area, there's 4 million people. Yet we have one professional club. We have one club that you can play for if you want to be a professional soccer player, and that's the Seattle Sounders. You have to be in the youth academy, and you can work your way all the way up if that's what you want to do. Stockholm has, I don't even think, 1 million people. And how many clubs can you play professionally for in Stockholm? I mean, 20?
Yeah, maybe? There are a few. Yeah, definitely. 1.5 million in Stockholm, just to
1.5.
get that in there.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, so as you can see, it's just a matter of accessibility. And just, you know, like when you join a club in the United States, you don't see the path. You know, you see like, okay, I'm going to go here. I can go to college, and then I can, you know, it just, there's no clear path. I think that has something to do with it. But And also, let me.
I think that. Yeah.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just gonna nip in there because personally, my journey as a player, like I played for my like really, I lived in a small village outside the town of Boden, where you eventually moved, and we had a local team there that I played with all through from the age of 8 till 15, and then I moved to the academy inside Boden, so in the city, about 20 minutes from where I live. And then when I joined the under 19 straight away. So we had an age kind of, we divided the team into ages, really. So we had from the age of 15, 16 up to 19. So you had like four layers of players. So you would have the oldest players who mostly played from the beginning, but then you had younger players like me and a few others who could, you know, get into the team and play as well. And we train with older players all the time. And then the oldest players, they would go and play with and go and train with the first team. So it's quite clear when I joined that, okay, so if I do well here, I know that, okay, I'm going to go and train with the first team. So mm-hmm. when I had a really good spell at 17, I went to train with the first team and I went to a few games on the bench. So it was really clear when I joined, okay, so if you do well or if you continue development, if you work hard, there's a clear pathway for you to actually go and join the first team. It wasn't like I can just train and train and train and then hopefully something will happen for me. It wasn't like that. It was really clear that, okay, today the first team is missing a center midfielder. Oh, they would just go into the youth team and bring one up to train with the first team. And you know that as well from when you play, that we had young players from my under-19s training with the first team on a regular basis, because we had that system in place to provide a sort of motivation for our young players to know that, okay, so if you do well, there's a chance for you. Like you have to grab that chance, but the chance is there. Everyone will get that opportunity to actually go and train with the first team if you perform in training. And I think that's really beneficial for young players to actually have that kind of carrot, you know, hanging in front of you mm-hmm. As you work your way through your weeks, that, you know, okay, you know, if I do well this week, I might have a bigger chance of going and training with the first team. And that's, I think that's really important to actually have that goal in sight. And for many players, the goal isn't the first team of Boden. The goal would be to go even further, but that would be a first step, really.
Yeah, and it's so helpful when you can see it all right there too. You know, you see the first team walking off the field and into the locker room. It's like, you know, like, wow, there they are. It's right there. It's, you know, you can imagine yourself, you can see yourself, you know, the visual part of it. I can't stress that enough in my opinion. When you're playing for just a random club in the United States, you don't see anything. You see the under 19s or the old, that's where it reaches before it moves on to university. And it's just like, okay, well, I'm going to, you know, I'll be on the oldest team. And then it's a mystery. Then it's who knows what's next. So the fact that everything is grouped together like that is so important. And I want to just like bring up a fun story that I've always thought about since I heard it. And that's the story of Southampton and their academy setup and how they constructed their clubhouse to be, you know, like as you go into the hallway of dressing rooms, of different dressing rooms, and you have, you know, towards the entrance, you have the younger teams, you have the under 13s, you know, and they have their little dressing room. And then the next door down the hallway is the under 15s maybe. And then, so as you graduate, you move further and further down the hallway where they have eventually the, you know, the under 21s and then finally the first team. So it's such like a, you know, it's a more visual carrot right there, just seeing yourself move down this hallway of different dressing rooms. But yeah, that the club system here is so incredibly different than it is over there. But yeah, I think that's a massive part to it, is to see, you know, what stage you will have, like, you know, what stage you're striving to get to. Yeah, I think that's and massive.
A big thing for us as well is that football is, or soccer, it's very accessible. Since there's not, the only thing you have to really pay for when you're a young player is your equipment, really. You have to have boots, but most clubs actually have a good few pairs laying around that you can always borrow and might even get if you know, if you don't have the means to go and buy yourself a new pair. So that would be the only thing you need, and then you would show up to training and there would be clothes laid out for you. So if you, when you join a team, you will always get a kit to train in, to actually, you know, create a sense of inclusion as well. But when you join a team, you get the same kind of kit that the other players have. So so that would obviously be important for a young player to when they join a new team. And it's only really when you join teams further up the hierarchy. So me again, going from my village team, there weren't many costs involved. You pay a yearly fee for membership, really, and that fee is always quite low. It's around $10 or $20 for most teams. And then if you join a team that goes around and plays against, you know, the teams from a bigger region, or they go to tournaments and you go on trips by bus, so you need, maybe you need to get food, or you might even need to sleep in a hotel for those kinds of clubs, then you have to pay more, because then you pay a price. I think that price could be around between $150 and $300 for a season, so for a year. And then you would get everything. So you would get your kit, you would get trips to games, you would get food at away games, and you would get obviously all your practice and all your opportunity to play would be included in that price. And most families in Sweden would afford that. And the few families that don't, especially at least at the club I played for and coached at, then we actually help those families. So those play, no player was ever, you know, excluded by not being able to pay the fee. So if they couldn't pay, then you had some kind of deal with, I don't know, with the community or something to make sure that those players also got the opportunity to play. So I think that's a big thing as well, that for us, obviously football is our biggest sport. I think I actually did a study on this a few years ago, that in terms of how many Swedes are involved in sports clubs, and we found that there was around 3.2 million out of our, I don't know, 10.5 that were involved in sports clubs as members or as players or coaches. And out of those, I would say 30-40% are involved in soccer. So you have around 10% of our population actually involved playing or coaching soccer, which is obviously a big thing. And then when all those people have actually the opportunity to go and do it, that will automatically help us to get players that we otherwise wouldn't get, because those players might have been excluded by not being able to pay to play, as I think it is in other countries. And I think that's an interesting comparison, because my understanding is that in America, you have to pay a lot more to actually just being able to train and play. Is that correct?
Your understanding is very accurate. It's at the club that I have a lot of kids who play for, a club here in Seattle. It's the biggest club in the Seattle area and therefore the state of Washington. It's called Crossfire Premier. And to my knowledge, those kids pay about $3,500 a year for club fees. And then on top of that, you know, you have to travel to all these tournaments. There's tournament fees. It's just incredible, and it's really sad, honestly, because soccer is definitely not, as accessible for everyone in the United States as it is in Europe and elsewhere, because it's simply, the field time aspect, there's so many different, reasons that it's just not a sport for everyone here in America, which is incredibly, it's a huge hindrance in our development, because we miss out on so many young athletes who choose to play other sports that are more accessible. That's totally spot on. And
can I just ask you then, Eddie, because what is it like when you play? Because as I mentioned, we don't really have school teams, and you obviously do. So when you play for your school team, is it the same that you have to pay a lot of money to play for that as well? Or is that more that the school provides the opportunity for its students to play?
Yeah, that's right. So when you get to high school is when you start to play for a school. And that's the from the ages of about 14 to 17, 17, 18. And so, yeah, that's a bit shorter of a season for the most part. Usually it's about 10 to 15 games. And it's usually a fall sport, so it's about 4 months usually. The season spans about 4 months. And the school will pay for all the travel and you know uniforms and everything, not really so much your boots, but yeah, that's one thing. And you see that a lot is players who don't play club soccer and they'll play high school. And sometimes those are, you know, players who you look at and say, wow, that's, you know, they've got something or other. It's not totally refined, but they've got, you can see they've got some sort of, you know, something to offer, but you know, they haven't been focusing on it as much just because they're not going to pay, you know, an extra $5,000-$6,000 a year for to play a game. It's just not in the cards. So yeah, that's definitely another aspect that really holds American soccer back is the access to soccer. But I will say that it seems like Sweden, you just play more soccer as well. Even if kids are playing club soccer over here, it seems like there's just more soccer being played in Sweden. The seasons are longer. They train, you know, almost every day. The numbers that I heard in Sweden that really stuck out to me and that made sense to me were 240, and that is 200 training sessions a year and 40 games. Do you have any numbers that you kind of like to use as guidelines for what players should be partaking in on a yearly basis for successful development?
No, like for me, the big thing is that the quality of the session and the quality of the coaching that players actually get, because I don't think that the youngest ages here would train 200 times a year. That would be like what, four sessions a week, something like that. And I know for certain that not all teams do that. Like a lot of, like when you are between, I would say maybe 14 and 19, and then obviously if you play for a professional team, then you would easily get that amount of training. But for the grassroots level where most coaches are volunteers, I would say that you probably train twice, maybe in some cases 3 times a week. But then the most important bit is, okay, so the quality of the session, not the number of the session, like so the quality over the quantity. So if you only have 2 sessions a week, which I for one have now with my team, we only have 2 sessions, or actually 3 some weeks, then I as a coach need to make sure that, okay, so this session it needs to be sharp, it needs to be full of content that the players can actually can grasp and can learn and can, you know, actually get better and develop from. So that would be the important thing for me, that even if you have one session or 2 sessions or 4 sessions a week, that make sure that each session is of a high quality. And as long as you do that, then I don't think the number of sessions matter. I think the most important bit for young players is to just play in their spare time as well, like you mentioned with access to pitches and stuff. And because we have that, depending on where you go in Sweden, you have a lot of access to places to play. And the big cities might not always be the same because, you know, towns and cities change and they develop, and they, you know, a lot of people want to live in the big cities, or big cities for us, not on an American scale. And then, you know, places to play are kind of replaced by, you know, apartment buildings and stuff. So that as long as you have the opportunity to go and play in the streets or in those courts you mentioned, then kids should take that opportunity to do that, because that's where they will learn even more. Because you might have 90 minutes in a session, and then you might have 2 days without a session, and you have 90 more minutes. But if you can go and actually play in those days off, if you will, then you will hone your technique even further. And then you will also learn from playing against your mates and playing against older players or playing against younger players. And you will learn how to maybe help the young players and how to, I don't know, evade tackles from bigger players, and all those little details will help you grow as a player. So I wouldn't say that there's a number of sessions that we need to do. I think we focus more and more on making sure that the quality of the session is right, because all people won't have the opportunity to train four nights a week. And that I think also that it might be a question of training too much at an early age might actually burn players in a way that they might lose interest. Like some kids, when I was a kid, I would have loved training every day. But then some kids, they like playing, but they also like, I don't know, driving their snowmobile if you live where I'm from, or you might like to go swimming, I don't know, or you just enjoy hanging out with your friends that don't play football. So if you train too much for them, it might actually, burn the candle from both ends, if you know what I mean, that you will lose focus and interest in the game. And I see that happening with some players when they get this extra school football, so that you go to train for your school team, and then at night you go and train with your club team, and then you go away and play a game at the weekend, and there are no real off days. And I think off days are important, and that's why I'm interested in the model that you mentioned with the school season. I know that was quite short, and that's a problem. We've kind of overcome our problem with the weather, that we've prolonged the season. When I started playing, the football season was really only from April to, I don't know, October maybe. So you had, was that 6 or 7 months of football, and then people would go and do ice hockey, or they would do athletics, or they would do something else that would take place indoor, like handball or something. But now more and more indoor football pitches are popping up across the country, which is only helpful, especially in the north where you know everything is covered by snow for 4 or 5 months, and if those 4 or 5 months would be spent playing handball or playing basketball, then we would also maybe risk losing players to those sports, but also those players would lose precious time actually working on their football ability. And yeah, I know there's an argument to be made that you can benefit from playing other sports, and I agree with that, but it's really good for us to have players actually playing football year round rather than just half a year. So that was a long answer to your question, but I hope you got what you wanted.
Yeah, I did. And I guess the key takeaway for me is, no matter what, like, everyone has their opinion on youth development, on what makes the best football player, etc. But I mean, I just don't think there's much more to say at the end of the day than kids need to just play. They need to compete. They need to be on a field or a court. And if they have the ability to play in their free time and their days off, uncoached, unparented, just under their own, supervision, that's what makes every single, all the players who end up being top professionals, they all just played in the streets and played in the parks all day. They had, their parents had to drag them into the house. That's what they all say. And that's just common sense to me, is like, if you want to be the best player, just get out. You got to get out there and play with your friends and be competitive and, understand what it means to be to compete. And I think there's just no way around that. If you want to be a top player, you got to just play as much as you can, period.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good note to probably end on. I think just get out and play. That's an important message, I think, for everyone.
Yeah, no, that's definitely the only advice that I would stand behind 100%. There's no other way than to just love the game and get out there and play it as much as you can. So I would definitely agree with that. But man, there's so much more to talk about on this topic, especially when we have insights like yours from a country that frankly is a good case study for for developing players, because you guys are a country that has a long winter, but it seems like you've done something very intelligent, because you do have a really successful young crop of players coming out of Sweden and playing elsewhere in Europe. So yeah, there's so much more to touch on, but for now, we will leave it at that. It's great talking to you, Dovs. I know you're starting your day over there, so I'll let you get to it. I'm going to get ready for bed, but let's get back on it soon and see what see what we can talk about next week. So great talking to you, buddy, and yeah, looking forward to the next one.
Yeah, likewise. Have a good night's sleep and then get started and recharge for tomorrow then for you.
Will do. Thanks, Dovs.
Cheers.
Thanks again, everyone, for tuning in to the second episode of Up Back Through, a coaching podcast brought to you by Running the Show, a blog for everyone in love with the beautiful game. Look for our next episode. We'll be back in about a week or so to talk more developmental and anything really to do with coaching and soccer. And we'll have some more Premier League and European action to talk about. But thanks for tuning in. We'll talk to you soon.